We are back. You are listening to the first episode of a brand new third season of The Meridian, and we are once again coming to you from Lund Observatory in southern Sweden. We are starting strong this season. A few weeks back, NASA astronaut Jim Pawelczyk, who is an associate professor of physiology, kinesiology, and medicine, visited Lund Observatory, and we convinced him to take a moment to join the podcast and talk about human space exploration. This third season also brings a new element that we are calling Cosmic Curiosities. Here we have some colleagues of ours bring out and discuss some ideas, events, or trivia from astronomic history. Yes, history has become legend, legend has become myth, and some things that should not have been forgotten will now be rediscovered in our Cosmic Curiosities. Stay tuned for that later in the episode.
The Meridian.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Nick.
It's good to have you back.
Yes, we're finally back doing season 3 of this pod.
After a year of our last season,
Yeah, it feels great to be back.
What have you been up to?
Yes, you might not have seen me around here at the observatory a lot, right? Because I spent half a year in Germany at ESO.
That's where you were. Yeah, I was just wondering, the horse crying for my lost co-host. What were you doing at ESO?
So I got an internship as a science communicator at ESO headquarters, which is in Munich, Germany.
Can you remind us what ESO is again?
Yeah, sure. So ESO stands for the European Southern Observatory, which is a 60-year-old organization of European countries that got together to build telescopes to put in the south or the southern hemisphere. Because you can imagine in Europe here, you only see a part of the sky.
So what do they have you doing then at the department?
So at ESO headquarters, they do developing and maintaining telescopes and instruments. They also do like, I guess it's like, I don't know, 300, 400 people at the headquarters. So it's like scientists, engineers. There's also a big group of admin. And then there is the visitor center and the communications department that I was part of.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So communications.
Exactly. So I did writing everything from like press releases, interviewed scientists for longer articles, wrote, they have this cute, I'd say cute picture of the week, which is like, it's a nice image, things like that. So everything communication.
Nice. Do you have any like really cool stories you'd like to share
with me? Well, I guess it was very cool to be there and like see the environment of ESO, but also I have to do like a bit of crisis management, which was of course not cool and fun, but it felt like good work experience to have, to see how we deal with different kinds of crises.
Right. I'm curious to what actually happened.
So there were like a few actually, but to mention one, for instance, ALMA, which is this radio telescope that ESO is a partner of, had a cyber attack.
What?
Which made it be shut down for I guess like 6 weeks or something before like they could take up observations again. And you know, as an observer yourself, you can imagine that, like, you know, not being able to do observations for 6 weeks is quite a lot.
A little heartbreaking for some people.
Yeah, no, really. It was, and like I never got to know, but it's very strange, like who would attack an observatory?
Yeah, it's not like we have financial records or any kind of like thing like that.
I think no data was lost or anything, so that's good. But I guess data were lost in the sense that they couldn't observe for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So that was, of course, not cool, but it was interesting to be part of that and to sort of see the behinds and how do we communicate this to, both the scientific community and the public community and on social media. And yeah, I got a lot of work experience doing that, and I thought it was amazingly fun to be there.
That's great. It sounds like the perfect place for you to work. So lots of communication work, but were you just doing that or did you have a chance to work on your own research?
As a like a PhD student yourself, it's quite hard to like just drop your science altogether.
Of course.
And yeah, I did actually, before leaving for ESO, I finished up two papers and I managed to get them published when I was away.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I did also keep in touch with helping out with teaching here, which it was an online course that could be done on distance. So that was actually good fun. So yeah, I kept my foot here as well.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess while it's been really fun to catch up, maybe we should try to do some podcasting.
I guess. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
And actually, so a few weeks ago, we had an astronaut visiting the observatory.
Yeah, Jim Pawelczyk.
And he flew with the STS-90 ESA Space Lab in the 90s.
Yeah, that was the one that had a lot of different animals on board. Like, it had like two types of fish or something like that.
Yes, exactly. So this time the space lab was called the Neural Lab. So Jim is a professor of kinesiology and physiology. So he studies the human body.
Mm.
So they had this various, as you said, various type of animals like rats and crickets and snails, apparently fish. And also, the crew itself to be part of the experiment to see how physiology is affected by space.
And it's kind of interesting because some people think astronomers are the ones that go into space, but we tend to actually have a larger group of other people that are more specialized because we like to observe from the ground or from our comfy chairs, but these are the people that need to do experiments on what it would be like being in space and the chemistries and how that develops in such an environment. So
no, that is true. Yeah,
I was really curious to hear what he had to say in this interview, so I'm the one that's gonna have the privilege to talk to him. So
all good fun and and it's like once an astronaut always an astronaut kind of deal.
Which
I think is cool.
You've like earned your stripes and so you've
exactly
got that.
But yeah, let's listen to Jim.
Yeah, let's do it. Now I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Jim Pawelczyk. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Nick, thanks for inviting me here. What a great opportunity.
It's an absolute pleasure. How have you been finding Lund?
Lund is a wonderful city. We've had some interesting weather. I believe they closed the bridge yesterday, so we've had some nice wind. But when we've been able to get out, it's an ancient city. I love that, but it has such a modern feel to it. A lot of young people, a lot of great thoughts happening here. I encourage everybody, come visit Lund.
Yeah, I love living here as well. It's a really nice city to live in. Maybe we should just jump right into it. Why did you want to become an astronaut?
Didn't everyone want to be an astronaut?
That's true.
So, yeah, I grew up in the 1960s, we're starting the human spaceflight program. Everybody wanted to be an astronaut. But originally, I wanted to be an entomologist. You know, I was that kid who was like looking around and looking under rocks and logs and finding bugs and classifying them all. And my parents even let me have a bottle of chloroform so I could, mount my own insects and bugs. And when I got into college, I was more, maybe more along the medical lines. And then I found this field called physiology. Mm-hmm. And of all things, I found it through the sport of swimming.
Yeah, okay.
On we went, more schooling, more learning. And ultimately, my research kind of brought me back to spaceflight. So I had an opportunity to combine science and space, and that's the best of both worlds.
So I guess, how do you combine physiology and space together? Like, that seems so far away from two distinct topics. So how did you find a way to marry those two?
Human spaceflight. It's the combination, right? So spaceflight is one of the most extreme forms of human physiology. When do you get a chance to study adaptation? And that's a lot of what physiology is. When you take away gravity, or at least take away the gravitational force on human beings, that's an amazing challenge. When we actually look at this at a genomic level, so we do a survey of as much of the genome as we can, we see large changes, so substantive changes in gene expression in almost 20% of the genome. Wow. That means that spaceflight is one of the most profound impacts on adaptation that we find of all the stresses we can think of.
Okay. So what are some of the things that can happen to you when you're in zero G space to your body? None of us have ever had that experience, but you have, and you have some insight. So can you sort of enlighten us a bit on that?
Well, so first of all, Nick, we need to work on that, right? There needs to be more people who go to space. So,
So
I'll see if I can put in a good word for you.
Oh, I'd love to go.
All right. So what are the things that happen? It's, we think of this really in sort of a time course. There are early adaptations, middle adaptations, late adaptations. And then the real question is, are there adaptations that occur over generations? Mm. And the answer to that last question is we don't know, but we need to find out. So let's go back to the first part of this. So when we first get into space, the thing that happens is, of course, is we lose the effect of the gravitational force. That changes the way that our gravity sensors in our inner ears are functioning. Most people immediately feel like they're either falling or they're upside down. Mm. So in falling, indeed, they are. That's what being in orbit is all about. It's falling around the Earth and the Earth rotates out of the way. So that's good. The upside down feeling comes from we've unloaded the otolith organs. So the only way that would normally happen is if your head was in an upside down position. So that's the early part. Sometimes for people that leads to forms of motion sickness that occur. So we see that in about 2/3 of astronauts, they have some symptoms of motion sickness. And then also along with that, there's a shift of fluid. So normally gravity keeps fluid, mostly blood, in the lower part of our body below our heart. Once that influence goes away, that fluid shifts forward, it shifts to the heart, and so the heart becomes very dilated and expanded, as do the lungs as well. And we can do that, we can accommodate more of that in the chest. And over time then, we do a couple things. Through the combination of the motion sickness and that volume shift, we end up consuming a little bit less water. And so the volume of water and blood in our body goes down over time. So that happens over the next couple days or so. As middle-term events, we start to see loss of muscle mass. And of course, we need muscles to keep us standing and moving. We don't need that as much when we're in flight. And so we see pretty dramatic losses unless we intervene by making sure that there's aggressive exercise. Mm. The longer-term effects then are really on bone. That's our slowest turnover tissue. And same thing with the loss of loading. You see that there is a loss of bone. And the rate that astronauts lose bone is pretty profound. It's on the order of about 1% per month. Okay. And just to put that in context, that's about the same rate as a postmenopausal woman would lose bone in a year.
Wow.
So we're 10 to 15 times faster than what we see for postmenopausal women for loss of bone.
So then what would be the symptoms of someone who, say, had spent maybe 5 years or a long period of time in space that you would predict?
Good question. And how would we change? How would we adapt? Well, there's a couple things that we can probably predict reliably. And so we see some of these vestibular changes. What happens is with less input, it's sort of like, okay, we need to turn up the gain for the little input that we have. Mm-hmm. So the gain of the vestibular system adapts over a couple week period, and it increases a lot. We were able to measure on our mission that it increases by an order of magnitude. Wow. How it goes out over months or years, I don't know the answer to that, but let's assume that that continues to be up. What that means is that when you come back down, if I were to push you, you would feel like you just moved a city block, right? It would be really, really dramatic the way you would feel. And we certainly see that happen in long-duration astronauts. So they have to readapt back to that gravitational environment. The biggest question that people have is, well, what's the effect on muscle and bone? And there's a couple different ways to answer that. If we did nothing to intervene with that, we could expect to see really large losses of muscle and bone. And we would predict, actually, losses of bone in some areas of our skeleton. So the hip, for example, or lower back in down around the ankle region, that you could lose as much as 50% of your bone.
Wow.
Now, currently, when we look at people who are on the International Space Station, we're not seeing rates like that. And the reason is because we are aggressively intervening with exercise. And there are some medications that you can use as well. So I won't be so bold as to say that we have the problem of bone loss licked. But I think we're doing a much better job at mitigating it. Have we completely solved it? We're getting closer. So 5 years later, which is an interesting number. It's a little bit longer than what we would say with going to Mars.
Yeah.
But these are the kinds of things that you're asking about are the kinds of things that we're worrying about when we go to Mars.
Yeah, so I think going forward, we're now sort of seeing an uptick in interest in resuming our space exploration with the Artemis program coming into effect. And we also have SpaceX now routinely sending rockets into space. So I guess, how important is it for us to understand these ideas and going forward, and how prolific will space exploration be going into the future, do you think?
I think we're going to see a continued growth in access to space, utilization of space, commercialization of space, and that is all to the good. And it's for all of the reasons that you mentioned, and we could probably do 10 podcasts talking about all of those different opportunities. So you mentioned the Artemis program, and indeed that is a program that is NASA-sponsored, but it has collaboration all over the world, and ESA is contributing mightily to this program. In fact, without ESA's contributions, really the Artemis program couldn't happen. Yeah. So thank you, ESA. What we're doing is, Artemis is named for whom?
I don't know, actually. I haven't. Could you outline me?
So Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo. So a very clever naming, because Artemis, the goal of Artemis will be, we will land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon.
That's
we can expect
step.
To see that, right?
Yeah.
So, and again, we view spaceflight, the future of spaceflight, in an egalitarian way. It is access and opportunity for all.
Yeah.
And so Artemis really symbolizes that as well. Mm. And that's the way it should be with spaceflight going forward. So the key difference, two key differences, is I see Artemis. One being that the time that we spend on the moon, we went to the moon back in when?
Late 1960s,
early 1970s. You are absolutely correct.
Yep.
And I'm glad that you agree that we went to the moon. We were not on a soundstage in southern Arizona somewhere.
No, I'm definitely sure we went to the moon.
Good, good, good. I agree with you completely on that as well.
That's great.
How long did we go? What was the longest time we spent on the moon then?
I'm going to guess around 7 days. That's my closest guess.
You need to go lower.
Lower?
Lower.
Okay. 3 days.
Exactly.
Okay.
3 days. Hey, I like this part where I ask you the questions instead. That's really good.
It's quite refreshing for me as well. So
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
So 3 days, here we are on the lunar surface. Now with Artemis, we're going to be looking at 30, 60, maybe even 90 day sorties. So we're really establishing not just a quick visit to the lunar surface, but actually an outpost on the lunar surface. Mm-hmm. So that's key technology innovation number one, that Artemis establishes an outpost on the moon where people of all nations and people who look, feel, all ways can come and interact. That's huge.
Yeah.
Second point is how we get there. And so we need to talk about the gateway. Mm-hmm. So the gateway sits at the second Lagrange point.
Yep.
Right? Why do we sit there?
Well, it's because it's gravitationally stable and it's a lot easier to keep.
Absolutely. Yeah. You nailed it. Station keeping is a great thing to do because we have a nice balanced gravitational field. So we're sitting about 40,000 miles beyond the moon, further than we've ever sent humans before. And so that's pretty cool. So is it just a gateway to the moon? No, not at all. It is a gateway to exploration of the inner solar system. That's the way we see this, for human exploration of the inner solar system. So if we put a small space station at a Lagrange point, what that means is we can send vehicles there and we can transfer humans to lunar descent vehicles, or we can transfer them to future interplanetary vehicles that will visit places like Mars. Mm-hmm. So having the gateway as part of the lunar architecture sets us up for future exploration of Mars as well. So three things. We are increasing the inclusion of human spaceflight. We are establishing an outpost on the lunar surface, which has never happened before. And we're establishing the architecture for visiting other planets.
It's very forward thinking. It's clear that the vision is long term. And I guess a lot of people my age or even younger than me sort of are getting excited by the fact that we may actually go to Mars one day and we will see the next person set foot on the surface like we did with Neil Armstrong back in the 1960s. Say we were to develop a Mars base, what would be some of the challenges we have to face with the environment that is on the Mars surface?
Great question. What does Mars look like as a type of environment? And I'm glad that you're feeling excitement about that, that possibility that, yeah, this is seeming a little more real, that we can actually do this. We are, and we can do that. But ultimately, it will be you and I are of different generations. I'm very thankful for that because your generation will be the ones that will complete this journey to landing on Mars.
Yeah.
And I look forward to watching it from a comfortable chair somewhere. So when we get there, you know, we're gonna face a different environment in terms of a gravitational field. We're gonna face different temperatures. It's gonna be a different radiation environment. We're gonna have an atmosphere, but it's an extremely thin atmosphere that if we tried to breathe it, we would be dead. And it's a composition that if we tried to breathe it, we would also be dead. So it's about 95% carbon dioxide.
Definitely doesn't sound so fun.
So, but it sounds like a good challenge, hopefully. And it also creates opportunity in that. So we're, you know, what's interesting is that we have had a global presence on around Mars for most of this millennium. So we have spacecraft around Mars that are mapping Mars, that are looking at some of the events that are occurring on Mars. We're understanding the planetary science of Mars with a fidelity that we've never had before. And Mars is a pretty dynamic place. It has a weather system, right? It has seasons. It has local weather events that are really interesting. We see meteors that are occurring, but we also have a much deeper understanding of maybe the key thing, which is the H2O.
Yep.
We know that there's water ice on Mars, that it exists. And we didn't have a good sense of that before. So now we have to learn how to harvest that, utilize that. And as we explore Mars, we will have to employ the resources of Mars. Okay, so water ice is there. That horrible sounding atmosphere. Well, it is an atmosphere. We can use that. We can even use that as part of landing. We can aerobrake.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, if it's a CO2 atmosphere, well, there's an opportunity for some carbon engineering. We're pretty good at carbon engineering here on Earth. We've been doing it for a long, long time.
Yeah. Maybe too good at carbon engineering.
Maybe too good at that. But at the same time, we're trying to think about how do we sequester and utilize CO2 in our own atmosphere.
Right.
Well, as we develop those technologies, they are absolutely scalable to Mars.
Yeah. So what kind of fuel could you create then? Because the idea is that you'd want to build a rocket on Mars and a refueling station. So can we make rocket fuel, or how do we get back off the surface?
Yes, you betcha we can make rocket fuel. We can make methane.
Okay.
It's not a very fancy rocket fuel, no. Right? But it'll get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, using Sabatier reaction, for example, we can work with carbon dioxide. We can work with water. We can make methane, right? We can make potable water.
Yeah.
As a result of that process. So we can actually do this pretty effectively doing in situ resource utilization.
Yeah. One of the things probably people don't think about is that Mars actually has weather. And I remember actually when I was studying my bachelor's, I worked with an astronomer who tracked the giant dust storm that happened in 2018
was a big one.
Yeah, that was, it completely covered the surface and turned into a bit, Mars was sort of a nice red marble basically for a long time. What effect would that have on the surface, and how is that, does that represent any danger to any humans who may have to interact with that when they're there?
It does. Yeah. So, you know, I know, you know, we all think about Mars, we sort of, you know, drift our mind back to the Martian.
Yes.
And this is one place where I love the Martian. I love the movie and I love the book even more. One place that got a little sensationalized in the movie was showing some of those storm events. Mm. We can expect those kinds of wind velocities. So, you know, 140, 150K
wow.
are pretty reasonable wind velocities. But remember, it's extremely low atmospheric pressure. So pressure that's generated at that wind speed, wind pressure, is more like what we would experience or counter with a gentle breeze.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not, you know, ripping antenna off of spacecraft kind of events, but it lofts these huge clouds of very fine and very light dust. And as you said, they take on a planetary scale. So for visualization, for solar arrays, these things are deeply concerning. And so the dust events, we really have to give strong consideration to. On the other hand, some of the local weather events, so the dust devils on Mars, have turned out to be, you know, a bit of a help for us. Yep. Because, you know, again, with low pressure but high velocity, as these things go across solar arrays, they're kind of great for fanning off the dust. Mm-hmm. And it's really helped our rovers on Mars and keep them going for much longer beyond their original design life.
Yeah. For those who may not know, what is exactly a dust devil? Because it seems a bit foreboding, actually, to hear about it. But it'd be great if you could elaborate
on it. Yeah, it's, you know, essentially it's a small cyclonic wind. So, it, you know, think of it as a very small tornado. And, you know, that too sounds scary. So, you know, let's to put that into perspective. You know, most people have been to the beach and they've maybe seen a little cyclonic wind. And that's that thing that sort of spins up and, you know, blows a few things around and maybe it grabs your towel and such. And you go, wow, that was kind of a crazy thing that happened on the beach. But it's, you know, it's not life-threatening in most cases. Mm-hmm. That's more the types of events that we're seeing.
Okay.
And these things are impressive on Mars, right? They're sort of ripping across the surface on a somewhat regular basis. Mm. Really neat to see.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're beginning around out of time, but I do want to ask one sort of more fun question. So you mentioned Andy Weir's book, The Martian. Mm-hmm. This was a book that I managed to read in 3 days because I was just I couldn't put it down.
I couldn't put it down.
I had a lot of other university assignments that I had to commit to, but this was just something I had to finish. What did you love about that book? And what is maybe one criticism that you could give to that book? Or I've heard he's omitted some facts for the dramatization. Like, what would be something that you'd like to point out for someone who may be interested in digging a little deeper into what is a really great piece of literature?
Okay, great question. So, yeah, and we're sticking with the book and not with the movie. And, you know, nothing personal, Matt Damon, but the book was way better.
I completely agree.
All right, so what is it that I would question about the book? So one of the things I first want to give props to the book, I loved it personally because Andy Weir really got astronaut's sense of humor.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little bit nerdy, a little bit technical, but still quite comical at the same time. And I was just roaring. I thought it was absolutely spectacular in that regard. But, you know, for example, the big explosion event that occurs, the methane explosion occurs because Mark Watney somehow forgot that expired air also contains oxygen. And indeed it does. You know, our inspired air is about 21% oxygen. Our expired air is typically about 16% oxygen. Mm. Every astronaut knows that.
Yep.
So it was a little bit of a miss on that one.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I loved how he used both very logical thinking and sort of explained how he was presented with a problem and how he would solve it. I think that was something as a scientist also you sort of see that.
As an American, I'd say MacGyver on Mars, right?
Yes, basically, yeah. That's a very good way of summarizing it, actually. And it also showed that it's great that like as an astronaut you relate to it because it was a very human piece of writing. Like you don't like astronauts tend to be, well, there's only a handful that have ever gone to space. Actually, how many have been to space?
Well, let's see. We're in the middle 500s right now.
So oh, wow.
Over the entire time course of human spaceflight, I think I'm like number 338.
Wow. So that might be a little bit more than a handful. But it's really good to know that these people are actually human. To know that they are human suggests that anyone can be an astronaut. Yep.
And the brilliance of the book, for me, the overall plot line, and here we're going to go back and we're going to give serious props to Matt Damon, is it brought out the idea of this profound isolation. You know, if you sit back in a quiet moment and close your eyes and try to imagine being on the Martian surface alone, and when you look up and you're looking at the sky field, the star field, and you see one star that is maybe a little bluer than the others, but it's very pale, not easy to see, and you go, that's Earth. That's where it is. think about that sense of isolation. I thought Andy did a wonderful job of using that in the storyline of the book and communicating it in words, and certainly Matt Damon, you know, showing it to us visually. And he conveyed that motion, I thought, beautifully.
I definitely think so too. He really captured our imaginations with that. Well, Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here on our podcast. We're both both humbled and super excited to that you have managed to find the time for us. Thank you so much for joining, and wish you the best of luck with whatever you pursue in the future.
Thanks, Nick. I really enjoyed being here, and you did a wonderful job answering all of my questions.
Thank you very much.
This is Cosmic Curiosities. My name's Lucian, and with me at the microphone today, I have Russ Church, who is a lecturer here at Lund Observatory, researching stars in the Galactic Center. So Russ, what cosmic curiosity have you brought with you?
So I have brought Tycho Brahe's cosmology. Tycho was an early adopter of the Copernican cosmological system, where the planets move on circular orbits around the sun. But there were problems that he identified with Copernicus's cosmology. It was hard to reconcile with the existence of comets, because in Copernicus's cosmology, the planets moved on spheres, but Tycho had shown that comets, which had previously been thought to be atmospherical phenomena like the weather or lightning, were actually astronomical objects, and that they moved through the different spheres, which suggested that they couldn't exist. But the other big problem was that in Copernicus's cosmology, the Earth is moving, and that means that the stars should show an apparent motion through the year as a result of seeing them from a moving platform. Yes. And Tycho had looked hard and made very precise observations of the positions of the stars, and he couldn't detect any such parallax, as we call it today.
So why was that the case?
What we believe now is that Tycho could not detect the parallax simply because the stars are too far away. He was working before the invention of the telescope, so the precision with which he could measure positions on the sky was limited. And in fact, the first convincing measurement of a stellar parallax was made in 1838, almost 250 years after Tycho's work.
I guess back then they didn't really have an idea of how far actually away stars may be.
No, indeed, not at all.
So what was Tycho's approach then?
So Tycho had a sort of dual solution which merged elements of Copernicus's cosmology and the previous Aristotelian cosmology. So in Tycho's solution, the planets all orbited the sun, except that the sun then orbited the Earth. So he still had a stationary Earth at the centre of the universe, which he thought was required on religious grounds, on scriptural grounds, and as a result would expect not to see parallaxes of the stars because his Earth was stationary. And this required the orbits to intersect with one another. So he did away with the idea of these invisible spheres that Copernicus had. He simply said that they weren't there.
You mean intersect as in they crash into each other?
Exactly. The orbits pass through one another because they, in his model, they are swept round, the orbits of the planets are swept round with the sun and intersect with the orbit of the sun around the Earth.
That means they have to be in some sort of resonance so they actually would not physically crash into each other, right?
That is certainly one way of looking at it. Tycho, of course, didn't think that the planets had any effect on one another because the concept of universal gravitation, of forces between all the objects in the solar system, comes much later with Newton.
Newton, of course, yes. How is it perceived? I mean, it's certainly a solution that should please the church more if the Earth is still in the center of the universe.
Yes, Tycho's cosmological model, I think, was was quite influential. It was, the details were superseded by Kepler's work. Kepler was Tycho's assistant for a number of years and essentially took over his work after Tycho died. But Kepler was less of an observer. Tycho's great contribution was in precise observation. Kepler was more of a mathematician, and he showed that it was necessary to have elliptical orbits to explain Tycho's observational data.
Mm-hmm. So Tycho himself did not really... But did he know about elliptical orbits, or did they always assume circular ones?
His orbits were all circular.
Interesting.
Previous cosmological models had, while circular orbits, they had what were called epicycles, which were additional circles superimposed onto the main circular orbit.
Wow.
And that was necessary to get more accurate positions, because, as we know now, the planets don't move in perfect circles.
Exactly. So who was Tycho?
Tycho was a Danish nobleman. He was born in Knutstorp, which is now in Skåne in Sweden, in 1546. And his interest in astronomy was spurred by observing an eclipse in 1560, but then in particular the supernova of 1572.
A supernova?
So, a supernova is an exploding star, which happens at the ends of the lives of massive stars and in some interacting pairs of stars, binary stars. And it was the latter sort, we believe now, that Tycho observed. And the supernova was bright enough that it could be seen in the daytime with the naked eye.
That is amazing. I wish I was there to see that.
Yeah, and it was the last but one supernova in our galaxy, in the Milky Way. There was a supernova in
1987.
But that was in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a satellite of the Milky Way. So it was a little bit further away than Tycho's supernova and could only be seen with a telescope. Yes, but coming back to Tycho, the supernova made him famous, essentially. He wrote a book about how it should be understood and interpreted, and convinced the Danish king that he should be appointed the court astrologer and granted the island of Ven in the Øresund near Lund to use the income from to construct a castle and an observatory and later on a paper mill and a printing press. And he used the, somewhat controversially, the labour of the peasants on the island to do a lot of this work. And then assembled what was essentially an early research centre on Ven, funded by the proceeds of that estate on the island and also various other estates around Denmark that the king granted him.
But are you absolutely sure today that Tycho's cosmology is not valid?
We are, and there are two good reasons for that. The first is the parallaxes, that we can now measure the relative positions of planets on the stars throughout the year due to the Earth's motion. But the other thing is that we can measure the Earth's motion with respect to the stars directly by what's called stellar aberration, which was an effect first observed in the early 1700s by Bradley. And that really was the first time that it was conclusively shown that the Earth was moving with respect to the stars.
I have to admit, I don't know what stellar aberration is.
So it is due to essentially the angle that one observes the star at changes because it's being observed from a moving platform. It's somewhat like a Doppler shift. The angle changes by an amount that's proportional to the ratio of the Earth's velocity to the speed of light.
It's like an angle of attack thing.
An angle of attack thing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you.
This was the first first episode of the third season, The Meridian, first published on March 10th, 2023. It was hosted by me, Rebecca Forsberg, and Nicholas Borsato, and our producer was Anna Anadottir. Our guest today was NASA astronaut Jim Pavelczyk, and today's Cosmic Curiosity was brought to you by none less than Lucian Spitzner and Ross Church. If you have any comments or questions about the show, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observe account on Twitter. The theme at the beginning of the show included voices of Astronomisk Ungdom, who attended a research school we hosted here at Lund Observatory back in 2021. Make sure you tune into next week's episode when we have Ruth Pötkin crossing our local meridian, talking about her work on dark matter, along with some more cosmic curiosities. Thank you for listening.